You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering, and celebrity chef Tiffany Faison is here in Studio 2. Welcome back.
Hi, hi.
How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. You've been doing a lot of TV. That's kind of part of what I'd like to talk to you about today.
Yeah.
So let's start with the food festival.
Okay.
Big Queer Food Festival.
Yes, let's start with that.
Just this last weekend.
Sunday night, yeah.
In Boston.
In Boston.
And you are the one who convinced it to come to Boston.
I think it was a group effort. So I work with David Lewis and Chad Hani, and they're the founders of the festival. They're dear friends of mine. They're producers in TV. So this is kind of their baby, and I've worked with them to like do some events in LA and eventually brought them to Boston. So yeah, it was a really great opportunity to bring them east. I think it was like this idea of a festival that will ultimately move to different cities. And it was like, hey guys, you can't just kick it in California. Like, come on over.
So what does it do?
It raises money and awareness for what will ultimately be like a full weekend festival that will be like a more traditional festival than the likes of South Beach or, you know, Pebble Beach Food and Wine, whatever that might be. Typically, food festivals celebrate a type of cuisine, a location. They bring chefs in. There's never been a food festival that just celebrates queer chefs and the contributions of the LGBTQIA community in food. So, which is wild to me that like we've been here for so long, like forever. James Beard was gay, like come on. And there's never been any like formal celebration of that in a festival. So they're changing it, and I'm only happy to be a part of helping them with it. It was a little nerve-wracking. Like, it was, you know, bringing everything to Boston, and we had incredible chefs around here that have contributed to it. Robert Gonzalez, Karen Akunowitz, Tatiana Rosana, Michelle Ragusas, dear friends came and were thrilled to be there. It was a little bit like going to a junior high dance. Like, I was like, are people going to come? Is anyone going to ask me to dance? And then, you know, tickets sort of trickled a little bit, which is normal for ticket sales and something like this. And it was like, we got to 200. We sold out at 400. And I was like, ooh, are we going to get to 400? And then, like 2 days before, it was like, boom, we're done, 400. And there was a line around the block at
That's like
430.
That's one heck of a junior high dance.
Yeah, it was better than my actual junior high dances, I'll tell you that much.
So on a night like that, do you taste a lot of food? Do you eat and drink a lot on a night like
I'm
that?
I'm cooking in a night You're like cooking. That. So I was actually hosting this time. So my team had four different bites from Big Heart Hospitality. We had stuff from each of the restaurants that we were representing that were in High Street Place because it was at High Street Place. Mm-hmm. And then the governor and her partner came and were kind enough to hang, not just come and say a couple words, but like hang out and meet people. And it was just, it was a celebration of food and queerness and joy in Boston. And it really filled my tank in a time that like maybe it was time to go to the gas station. Yeah. So tank's full. It was good.
I did want to ask you, and so if you were cooking, you might not be able to answer the question,
sure.
But in case you can, was there anything you tasted that night from another chef that you're like, mwah, I got to call that out?
Michelle Ragusas is just such an incredible chef. She's half Greek and half Italian, and it shows up in her food. Her food is robust, and it's comforting, and it's elegant all at the same time. She made these like gorgeous arancini that I was like, this is what I need, like a deep fried risotto ball with like a beautiful fonduta on top and a little bit of red sauce. And I've had that dish in like a million different ways. There was something, I think, just combination of herbs in it and the way she made it and the like robustness of like how it was made, the creaminess of the inside and the fry on the, it was so, so good. It was great.
Nice.
Super Gay Vodka was there. They're a vodka brand that's been working out of like Hudson Valley area. They were great. Provincetown Brewing Company was there. I love what they do. Rhodesium, they do like beautiful gins and vodkas. And they had this walnut vodka liqueur thing. If that's on every espresso martini anyone orders ever, I don't know what to tell you.
Walnut vodka liqueur.
Yeah, it's Rhodesium. Just, they're in Whole Foods. They're local. They're queer made. Go buy their stuff and just pour it on ice.
Wow, that sounds
delicious.
And be done with
it. Exactly.
All right. So before we sort of off this subject, how many TV shows are you either currently shooting or are on air that you already filmed?
Chopped, Triple G, so Guys, Grocery Games, Triple D, Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, Wildcard Kitchen, and Best Bite in Town.
And Best Bite in Town is also a Guy Fieri, right?
Correct.
Yes.
So Wildcard Kitchen, actually the series finale, the season finale is tonight. It's the most fun. It's like three chefs come into a kitchen, you come into the Food Network studios after hours. My dear friend Eric Ajapong is like hosting a card game. We're all playing with our own money, which is a little, And we're playing poker. And then, you know, it's not normal poker. It's like we get these cards and we have to cook to these cards.
So, why do you pick the most stressful things to do on television cooking shows?
Television cooking shows are inherently stressful. That's
why
they're fun to watch.
Why do you do that?
Because I don't like myself. I don't know. It's really deeply fun. It really is. Like, and it seems like it's that. Some of them are like nauseatingly stressful, like Tournament of Champions. That's like just incredibly hard.
Which you went out partway through this time.
Yeah, yeah.
You've won it in the past.
Won it in the past. Yes, exactly. Punch My Card, season 3. Manit won this year. She won 2-time belter, that lady. She's a powerhouse. And yeah, it's super fun and I enjoy it. It's very, very stressful and it takes a lot out of you. This is like one night, one day, we shoot it, you come in, you have fun with your friends, we're drinking and cooking at the same time. And so it's less consequential. It's like a couple $1,000 that I lost. It's not the biggest deal in the world. Don't get me wrong, like a couple $1,000 is big money for me, but it's also really fun. Best Bite in Town, less consequential. Actually, like one of the first shows I've been able to just be myself.
And that's
on.
Where people go out to different places around the country and try foods to find the best bite.
Exactly. So essentially, Guy picks cities that he wants us to go to. We have something called the Bite Club. There's teams of two. So Jet Tila and I are a team. We go out with Noah Kapp and we each go to two restaurants, try two dishes at each of the restaurants, and then we decide what we think is the best, kind of bring it to the town square, and then we bring it to the judges in the town square, and all the people from these like lovely towns are there, and it's really fun. And then there's like someone gets crowned the best bite in town, and then if you lose, you have to do like humiliating things, which is it's not that humiliating.
As if you lost a fantasy football pool or something.
Correct.
Like that.
So there's like a I don't know what I can give away. I think it's already showed. So I won once, and Noah and Jet had to like ride around Davis on a bicycle,
Davis
a tandem
Square.
Bicycle. Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to bring us into sort of a best bite in town, but a more serious version of that conversation. And as we do that, we're going to bring another guest. Literally, Alvin Buyinza, who's a Mass Live reporter, is walking into
hey,
the
Alvin.
Studio while we talk. Hey there, Alvin. You're going to sit down, throw those headphones on, and say hello into that mic.
Hey, how are you?
Good, hello. How are you? So, best bite in town, in that one of the ways to know if restaurants are really great is to give them a thing called a Michelin star, right? And Alvin, you wrote a story that really caught our attention on the fact that there are no Michelin stars for restaurants in Massachusetts.
Yes.
And this comes from a Michelin guide. Correct me if I'm wrong on this. Michelin guide was actually two brothers who started a tire company in around 1900. And to sell more tires, built like a little booklet that grew over time, figuring if they could get people to drive from place to place to try places like restaurants, they'd wear their tires out sooner and need to buy more tires.
Yes, that's correct.
Right.
That's correct.
So it evolves into this amazing guide where one star is not a bad thing. Tiffany, one star is a really good thing.
Good thing means different things than a 2 or 3 star restaurant.
Right.
So and there's also a Bib Garmont. So yeah, the Michelin guide is essentially, it's a published guide. It's now online and it used to be books where the Michelin people, the association, what do you want to call them, they decide where they're going to go. Heavily based in Europe first, really based in Europe first before it expanded. I think the first expansions were to Asia and the United States.
Within like the last 20 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's different levels. There's a Michelin recommended Bib Garmont, right? So you don't get a star, but they say, hey, good job. Pat on the head.
Best
right?
bite in town.
Best
right.
bite in town. Exactly. We love it. We love it. We're not going to, you know, don't wear your tires out, but we love it. 1 star is we really like you. 2 stars is like your next level. 3 stars is the highest you can get. It has traditionally been something that has been systemically very difficult in Europe, but it's driven like incredible restaurants, don't get me wrong. Very traditional, like hierarchical, very kind of white guy, yelly, screamy restaurants, like abusive restaurants. And they didn't do that, but they definitely promoted that. Like multiple chefs have worked their entire lives for like getting 3 stars and then maintaining that stars and the 3 stars. Losing a star is like life altering. Chefs have committed suicide. I mean,
it is.
Oh my God.
So there's a dark side to this.
Yeah.
And also this, I will say this, they say that it's based on 5 different things, quality products, mastery of flavor and cooking techniques, personality of the chef and the cuisine, value for the money and consistency of food. Generally, yes. But then there's like a whole nother side that is like, there's no transparency in this whatsoever.
All right. So if you or someone that you love is experiencing a mental health crisis, by the way, you can dial or text 988 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We always want to, you know, offer that resource. So with that in mind, Alvin, you then decided to dive into why we don't have any Michelin-starred restaurants here and whether people think that's a good thing, which I think Tiffany has sort of laid out the pros and cons of that. Why don't we have any Michelin-starred restaurants in Massachusetts?
So that's a really good question. And it's a question that I kind of had to almost shake out of Michelin, the French tire company. If you look at my email inbox, it's like a 20-long email chain going back and forth, just trying to get an answer.
To the transparency point that Tiffany was making.
Yes. So the best answer they gave me is they don't have any news to share about additional guides in North America. And they said that they're anonymous inspectors. They're always kind of on the prowl for new bubbling destinations. And once they see one, they'll begin to start their reviewing process. But here's the catch, they don't reveal their process on how they select a destination. So there is that lack of transparency. And that lack of transparency kind of keeps some restaurant owners, some chefs in the dark about, you know, when a new Michelin guide is going to come in. So that's according to my reporting from MassLive.
Now, one of the other things that was in your article, Alvin, that I'm curious about was the idea that there might be a pay-to-play, and I'm using a controversial term on purpose here,
right?
But that there might be a dimension where there is a pay-in for a city or a region to get the guide. Can you explain that to us a little bit?
So what you're referring to as the pay-to-play, according to the Michelin Guide, they're trying to grow its influence. So they'll at times seek out partnerships with local tourism boards to help show off a new location, a new gastronomic scene. And the money that they get from these tourism boards, it covers the cost incurred from establishing a guide, you know, promoting the selection, highlighting a new restaurant. That's according to the company, what they told MassLive. The money that sometimes these tourism boards will have to shell out, it's hefty. So in 2023, the Colorado Tourism Office paid over $100,000 for over 3 years for a Michelin guide. That's according to New York Times. In 2022, the Florida paid in city and state budgets, ready, hear this, $1.5 million for a Michelin guide in Orlando, Miami, and Tampa. That's according to investigation. So there is a hefty amount of money that these tourism boards are paying the French tire company to kind of create a new guide in this destination.
So, Tiffany, on balance then, in a place like Boston with a burgeoning, you know, strong food scene, in the food community, a thing in general people want, a thing they don't want, listen, don't bring that toxicity here.
I think it's mixed. I think they're, like, it would... The idea of it is to get more people to come to the region, right? It really is like to invite tourists and to like bring people into the region to be experiencing the restaurants that we have. Would it help in that? Probably, yes. It also tends to attract like a very specific type of tourist that is like very, very wealthy, looking for those 3-star restaurants. Mm-hmm. Like there are people that just go to 2- and 3-star restaurants all the time. So I am probably the best and worst person to ask about this because I live in this community and I want us to thrive. I don't have a lot of patience for like award systems that don't have any transparency. And I think, you know, to Alvin's point, the sort of rote answers and we're not expanding right now. We don't have any plans to come to North America because we're not seeing the checks that we want seen. So just to give a little bit more perspective on this, like Australia paid $600,000 to just host the awards in 2017. Seoul paid $1.8 million to have them come to Seoul in 2018. Thailand paid $4.4 million over 5 years to have them come. So this is major, major money. So their answer to this is, you know, it helps establish the guide in certain areas. This is not a place that has like a large office or like a workforce that is identifiable. There are people that also like work normal jobs and they say that their inspectors pay for their own meals. So you're not reimbursing them. Like, where is the money going exactly? So it's a business. It's a for-profit business.
Alvin, what surprised you the most in reporting this?
In reporting this, I think what surprised me the most is how much some chefs will seek this out. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in my story, I had the honor of speaking to Rachel Miller. She's the owner of Nightshade Noodle Bar in
downtown.
We've
had her here on Radio Boss.
She's fantastic.
So
and what was so surprising is the fact that she said that the Michelin Guide, it's so incredibly important to her. She's considered moving, from the Boston area to a city where the Michelin Guide is because it's so incredibly important to her. You know, she said that she has a goal of when she wanted to make the Nightshade Noodle Bar, she had a goal of making this a destination spot. And she's almost said that, you know, it feels like she can't do that without this Michelin guide. It's so important that she's considered up and moving. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important because it highlights for some chefs how this is really for them a resume builder, as mm-hmm. Miller put it. And it highlights, you know, how incredibly influential it is in, you know, the culinary scene.
So, Tiffany, in our last 30 seconds, yeah. Rachel's a James Beard Award nominee.
I love her so much, yeah.
You've talked about
she's genius.
Lack of transparency with James Beard, yep. with Michelin. Is there an award out there, 20 seconds now, that is a great award?
Yeah. Happy guests. Financially robust restaurants.
Fantastic. Period. There you go. Yep. Well, I was expecting that to take longer, but we can just end there. This has been fantastic. Celebrity chef Tiffany Faison, always great to have you with us. Thanks
for
so
having
much.
Me. Always great to be here.
And Mass Live reporter Alvin Buyinza, thanks so much to you, too.
It was great having me. It was great to be here.